Hey there, podcast listener. This is Meg Malone, VPR's digital producer, and I am just letting you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity, keeping it to the point. So let's get started.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kack in for Jane Lindholm. The number of refugees entering the United States has fallen dramatically in the last 3 years, nationwide and in Vermont. In 2016, for instance, the U.S. resettled about 85,000 refugees, while this year the number was fewer than 30,000. President Trump is considering cutting refugees even more for the coming fiscal year, which begins October 1st. Here to talk about how all of that impacts Vermont is Amelia Marjanovic. She directs the Vermont Office of the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, which is based in Colchester. The group advocates for the rights of immigrants and helps with their transition to life in Vermont. Amelia, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, too.
And for a broader perspective, we're joined by Lee Williams. He's a senior vice president for the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, Amelia's parent organization. He directs management responsibilities for the committee's field offices, which are located across the country. Leah, pleasure to have you on the program as well.
Thanks, Nina.
So, Lee Williams, let me start with you. According to the U.S. Refugee Act, which Congress passed in 1980, the president, in consultation with Congress, is responsible for setting the number of refugees that can be admitted each fiscal year. And since taking office, President Trump has made it very clear he thinks the U.S. should be taking in fewer refugees. So the fiscal year starts in less than a week. Does anyone have a sense of what the president plans to do with regard to resettlement quotas for next year?
Well, there's certainly a lot of rumors flying around at this point. We have heard everything from a limit of basically zero refugees coming in to 8,000, 15,000. As you mentioned, this year, the target for fiscal year 2019, which is ending next week, was 30,000. So that's really the range. No one is talking about more than that.
So you talked about zero, and I heard about those rumors, too. Aides have been pushing the president to just cancel resettlement completely. How worried or how realistic is that drastic of a step, do you think?
It's well within the realm of possibilities. The Trump administration has really implemented some very restrictionist policies when it comes to immigration in general, and that includes both asylum as well as refugee resettlement.
And do you get a sense what his main reasons are why he feels so strongly about limiting? Is it safety? Is it cost?
Yeah, I would defer to the administration to answer that question.
Amelia Marjanovic, how have the president's cuts impacted the number of refugees right here in Vermont?
So just to look back quickly at 2016, we welcomed 386 refugees in the last – that was the last year of Obama administration. And this year, we're 5 days away from the end of the fiscal year 19, and we welcomed 115. So it's less than a third of refugees that we welcomed only 3 years ago. So that is the most devastating impact of these policies. The number of people that are coming into the United States has been slashed, and therefore to Vermont.
Well, and I know some of the reports I've done this week, I was talking with Hussam Al-Halak, excuse me, and his wife Hazar. They are one of the Syrian families that arrived in Rutland a few years ago. They still have family in Damascus, and Hussam wants very much to bring his father to the United States. And I'm sure there are refugees in very similar situations all over that would like to bring families over. How have the recent cuts in quotas impacted their efforts to try and bring family over? Amelia.
So there are many families in similar situation. I have, almost regularly on a weekly basis, people come into my office, you know, making those inquiries, asking about their relatives overseas. And it's really devastating not to be able to tell them, to give them really any hope, any tangible answer, because nobody knows.
Before we get too much into, the specific cuts, I'm kind of wondering about funding mechanisms and how these cuts have ripple effects on just the funding that you're dealing with. Amelia, you said that, you know, you've seen the number of refugees coming to Vermont drop by a third or so. How's that transferring over to your funding?
So it's about equal. A third of our funding has also been reduced, which also resulted in staffing cuts. Some of that funding, some of the federal funding, is directly tied to the number of people. So the lower the number of people, obviously, the lower the funding.
Well, explain how that works then. What's your annual budget and how has that changed over the last 3 years? Do you get, you know, is it like the public schools where, you know, each individual refugee, you get a certain amount? And what is that amount?
So, as I said, a couple of the funding streams are directly tied to the number of refugees. For example, the reception and placement funding, which is coming from the State Department, Bureau for Populations, Refugees, and Migration, PRM, a certain amount, $11.50 to be specific, goes directly to refugees, which is known in the community as welcome money, which we use for, you know, to rent an apartment, pay utilities, buy some initial groceries. And then the same amount comes to the agency to support case management and administrative costs. The other funding streams are, I should also mention that a high percentage of our funding, overall funding, is coming from the federal government. And it is, it's a formula funding. So looking back at a couple years, that funding is known as Refugee Social Services. It's administered through the State Refugee Office at Agency for Human Services. And that funding supports English language learning, which we provide in-house, and employment services.
Lee Williams, bring that to a broader concept, or, you know, explain a little bit more fully how refugee resettlement is paid for nationwide, if you can.
Sure. So, as Amelia mentioned, these are national programs. The two major departments involved with the actual refugee resettlement are the Department of State, which runs the Reception and Placement Program, which is the initial funding for refugees coming to the United States. And then follow on to that, within the Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Children and Families is an office called the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which provides additional support for refugees as organizations such as USCRI work with recently arrived refugees to help them establish their lives, find jobs, really start to integrate into their communities.
And okay, continue.
So, at a national level, with the Trump administration, I mean, the proposed budget submitted by the administration over the last couple of years have looked to cut the amount of funding available for these programs. However, the amount of funds allocated by Congress has remained fairly constant.
And what is that?
Well, it's really divided into a number of sections. For the State Department, it is a couple of billion dollars.
Okay.
But that's not just for refugee resettlement in the United States. That's for all the work that's done overseas to support the UN Refugee Agency to help folks overseas. The piece for the work in the United States is actually quite small, a very small portion of that.
So I'm sure there are people listening who like the idea of limiting refugees because it would reduce, they think, federal funding. And I'm wondering, Lee Williams, how much are we saving by the cuts that the Trump administration has made in recent years? Is there a way to quantify that?
I wouldn't be able to tell you on a national level. Again, in terms of appropriations, the money has stayed fairly constant for the last couple of years.
And could charities do this work alone without federal dollars? I mean, it is sort of a – right now it's working in a sort of a partnership between public and private nonprofits and charities that are doing this work.
Well, and I think that's a really important point, Nina, is the fact that these programs are known as public-private partnerships, where there are 9 national agencies who work, partner with the federal government for refugee resettlement across the nation. You know, the amount of money provided through these programs is really fairly meager, as Emila mentioned. And so for us to be successful in our programs, we really need to work closely with local civil society, with the local religious institutions, and with individuals to make sure that these folks get off to a really good start.
You know, at the beginning of this program, I was talking about the fact that the numbers that were throwing around, going from, you know, 80,000 down to 30,000, that they're actually their people and their families. Emila, can you talk a little bit about the refugees that are right here already in Vermont? Who are they and where do they come from?
So we are actually coming up on our 40th anniversary next year. A lot of people don't realize that refugee resettlement, not in this form, started, you know, way back in late 70s and early 80s. And some of the first arrivals to Vermont were, you know, refugees from former Soviet Union, Vietnamese, Cambodians, Tibetans. And then I'm just going to name a few. There's a whole slew. Bosnians, Somalis, Sudanese, Burundians, and Iraqis. And then in the last decade, our primary group has been Bhutanese, Burmese, Burundians, Iraqis, Somalis, and 3 Syrian families in
wow.
Rutland. And so close to 8,000 refugees, according to our data, which only goes back to 1989, have come to Vermont.
And you're a refugee yourself.
Yes, I am. I was. I guess I am.
You were. From Bosnia, right. And
yes.
I understand, as I recall, you came over to the United States in 1995.
I did, yeah, through the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program.
And remind people, Emila, what's the screening process? What do families need to go through? And I know it's a long process, but briefly give people a reminder of the actual process to become a refugee.
Mm-hmm. That has been sort of in the midst of this debate, you know, pro and against refugees. And one of the things that always comes up is this screening process. It is one of the more robust, I would say, screening processes that our government has for any visitor to the United States. So on average, for a single refugee, it takes about 1,000 days to
wow.
go through security screenings, health screenings, and to, you know, get to the travel. Also, it's important to mention that refugee resettlement is the last resort. The UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, always looks for repatriation as the first option or local integration. And then refugee resettlement becomes an option for less than 1% of the total number of refugees, which now is 25 million.
Wow.
Yeah, if I could add a couple of things to
Absolutely.
That. So, you know, the greatest tragedy to this whole diminishment of the program has to do with the number of people who won't be given the opportunity to come to the United States and establish new lives. I mean, according to the UN Refugee Agency, as of the end of 2018, there were over 70 million people displaced worldwide. And of that 70 million, 26 million qualified as refugees. And that equates to roughly a person being forcefully displaced from their home every 2 seconds.
Wow.
And as Emila mentioned, you know, third country resettlement, which is what we're talking about, is the third of what's known as the durable solutions. And it's really the last chance for a lot of people to have the opportunity to start their lives again in safety and build lives.
And I'm curious too, Lee Williams, that Emila was talking about the steps that refugee individuals, families need to go through to come to the United States. I think you said about 1,000 days. There's even longer screening, though, for people coming from countries like Iraq or Syria, different parts of the world. Can you talk a little bit about the enhanced vetting process that we started talking about a couple years ago?
Sure. So refugees, people who come to the U.S. through the Refugee Resettlement Program are by far the most vetted immigrants to the United States. So there are a number of national agencies involved in the security vetting process, including the FBI, the Department of Defense, the National Counterterrorism Center, the State Department, among other agencies. And there is an ongoing real-time security check going on against everyone who is a potential candidate for resettlement into the United States. So as Mila mentioned, you know, for a person coming from a country of not significant concern, that process can last anywhere from, you know, 2 to 2.5 years before they actually get on a plane to come to the United States. For those people who are coming from countries such as Syria or really, by and large, from Muslim countries, there are extra layers of security checks that are going on. Again, real time, constant, and the time frame for a person from those countries, when we were receiving people from those countries in significant numbers or larger numbers than now, was, you know, anywhere from 3 years to 3 years plus.
Let's take a phone call now from South Burlington. Kevin is on the line. Hi, Kevin. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. My question was about climate change. And my understanding is that people in coastal communities and in arid climates are going to find it increasingly difficult to live as climate change progresses. And so they're going to be more displaced people, migrants, and refugees. And then I've also read about a population loss throughout communities in the United States, and in Vermont in particular, that led to problems due to a lack of workforce. And it seems to me like there might be an opportunity here where people displaced due to climate change may help solve some of these workforce problems in Vermont and elsewhere in the United States if there's, you know, policies in place to welcome them. And I just wondered what the guests thought about that.
Right. Kevin, thanks for calling in. Emil, why don't you address the issue that he brings up about the workforce? Mm-hmm. Because I know that was definitely an issue in Rutland when they even started talking about refugee resettlement three
yes.
years ago.
Yep. Over the years, as I mentioned, you know, on average, so there's about 8,000 refugees that have come to the state. And on average, 200 employable adults per year entered the workforce. So with the declining number, numbers of refugees coming into Vermont and other communities around the country, there's a loss. There's a huge loss. And we almost on a daily basis hear from area employers who have, you know, over the years relied on refugees to fill their positions. They're asking for people and, you know, there simply aren't people.
We had a caller just a few minutes ago, Kevin, wondering about potentially an influx of refugees in the future due to climate change. And Lee Williams, I want to ask you about that. We've talked about how cuts are threatening nonprofit organizations that help with resettlement, like Amila's efforts right here in Vermont. How concerned are you with future refugee crises that may come up that the country won't be able to handle them?
Kevin's question was great, and it's certainly timely when we think about what's going on in New York right now with the New York General, the UN General Assembly meeting taking place this week and the discussions going on about climate change. You know, I think we're already seeing an increase in migration from the areas that are either facing flooding or violent weather or also droughts. Certainly one of the issues that impacts the number of people coming from Guatemala at this point has to do with the drought that's ongoing in some of the farming areas. It is certainly a topic of discussion at this point. I think it's still early days. If we look at the definition, the internationally recognized definitions of a refugee and also the refugee regimes that exist currently, it is still very much focused on people fleeing violence. But there is growing recognition that that definition needs to be adjusted to take into account for people who are facing peril because of changing environments and climate change.
So I want to follow up, though. You know, with the cuts that we've been talking about, Amila was saying it's difficult, I think, to plan and to create a budget when you don't know how much funding you're going to get in the coming years. If we lose local resettlement agencies, how easy is it going to be to reopen them or re-jumpstart them into action if we need them in the future?
It's not easy at the local level because Amila and her team and agencies across the country spend a lot of time fostering relationships with landlords, with community members, with volunteers, with religious communities and all to help welcome these people into the new communities. And those, you know, you can't flip those on like a light switch at a national level with the federal government. I mean, the federal government is not necessarily quick to change. So we see currently, even with smaller interruptions, whether it's because of government shutdown due to lack of budget or whatever, just small amounts of time that interrupts the process can have really negative impacts on people who are in the process of resettling. And that's the cause of that is, as we were talking about earlier, all of these folks go through numerous security checks as well as health checks. And each of those clearances has a shelf life. And so there's typically a very small window of opportunity when all of their checks, both health and security, are valid and clear and we can get people on the plane. So even small interruptions to that process of a couple of weeks can cause people to have to wait, you know, months if not years longer to get into the resettlement program.
Scott on Facebook commented that I am cool with folks coming here, but they must become quote-unquote Americans and not hyphenated Americans. Christine in Middlebury emailed us, respect and gratitude to our then U.S. Attorney Eric Miller for the devoted leadership and collaboration to civil rights and to the Syrian refugee resettlement that occurred in Vermont. He embodied the idea of protect and serve in Vermont. 1-800-639-2211 is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us up and do that again. 800-639-2211. Let's take a call now from Joe, who's calling from Saratoga. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
I just want to say I really like the idea of people coming here, especially people who are in dire circumstances. I just want to ask, though, I do have an experience here. I was in the park with my dog, a Karen Terrier, in Saratoga. You know, I take him to into the stream every day. And there were some refugees there, and they didn't like the idea of me having a dog there, because where they're from, it's not done. So I was wondering, are these types of people given classes on what is normal for here, or should I maybe not take my dog to the park again because it's upsetting them, or because I feel that people should be able to do things that we normally do when refugees come?
Joe, let me pick it up. Let me pick it up with Amila Majanovic. What kind of courses and how are refugees given coursework on, I think, how to live in the United States mm-hmm. as far as cultural classes is what I'm asking.
Yes. So prior to departure, refugees are required to attend cultural orientation. And these classes are, delivered. It's a classroom style over 2 or 3 days. And they cover topics, you know, anything from schooling in the United States, healthcare, you know, safety, hygiene, the role of the resettlement agency, and, you know, community life and so forth. And then after they arrive in the first 30 days, we also provide cultural orientation. And we cover some of the same topics. Oftentimes we bring in guest speakers, either someone from a fire department or a local health provider or from somebody from another social service agency. So it's quite intensive and in-depth. But also, you know, people are new and they're adjusting, you know, to the time and everything. So it really takes, you know, several times to reiterate some of these messages.
Well, and I know in talking with some of the Syrian families who've arrived in Rutland, they said that local volunteers were very helpful and that they felt as though they could call neighbors and volunteers and say, hey, I've got a
Absolutely.
Question about this issue came up. What do I do? Or so it seems like they do rely on people in the community
yes.
to help them out to answer
Absolutely.
Those questions. Let's take another phone call. Let's go to West Hartford now and take a phone call from Mary Ann. Hi, Mary Ann. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about refugees who have assimilated into our culture. There are many who come who are very highly educated, who may have had governmental or other types of jobs that I see them more or less getting menial work. And I'm wondering if this is being addressed.
Amila's
a lot
nodding
of times,
her head.
Yes. When people first arrive, they do take you know, entry-level positions. I myself started at a bakery in Burlington and then sort of worked myself up over the years. It is, you know, certainly more difficult, you know, someone coming, you know, in their 40s or 50s with, you know, no English and it's more difficult, I guess, to re-enter some of those more professional positions, but not impossible. You know, we have, you know, teachers and, you know, people working in professional positions.
Well, and that's exactly the story I heard from Hussam Al-Halak mm-hmm. in Rutland in a story that I worked on this week. He started – he was joking that he was yeah. the muffin man and worked at a bakery in Rutland, and now he's a tax accountant for Casella. So I think it just takes some time.
Yes.
One thing I wanted to dig into a little bit in the last few minutes that we're on today is the economic impact, mm-hmm. Which I think is a good segue. There was an interesting – a report that came to light earlier this month from I think it was the Health and Human Services had looked into the economic impact of refugees, and it was described as the first rigorous accounting of their economic impact. And the draft of that report found that refugees brought in $63 billion more in government revenues over the past decade than they cost. I found it interesting that the White House rejected that study, did not release it, and it's only been made public because of investigation efforts by reporters like at the New York Times. Lee Williams, what did you think of that report and the White House's reaction to it?
I'm not surprised about a couple of different things. First of all, Nina, that report was actually required to be produced by the Trump administration based on the second travel ban that was introduced in March of 2017. It was, and you're absolutely right, it was initially meant to show the costs of the refugee resettlement program, but the researchers also threw in the economic benefits of having refugees move into communities. And the net result was a finding that over this 10-year period, the refugee community contributed over $290 billion, with a B, additional tax dollars, and the net in between what they were contributing to the economy versus what was being used by them, specifically when they were initially resettled in the U.S., netted a $63 billion gain to the U.S. economy, to the country. And I think we see these analyses all across the country. There have been a number of local analyses. I can think of ones that were done in Buffalo, New York, in Cleveland, Ohio, and St. Louis, Missouri, that had similar impacts and similar results with refugees coming in and establishing new businesses, buying homes in neighborhoods that may have become unstable for various reasons. and really having a net positive impact on their communities. And I would just add that as well as the population decline in Vermont, and USCRI is working with the city of Erie, Pennsylvania, with the city of Detroit, Michigan, and Cleveland, all places that have suffered declines in population and who are looking to stabilize their population and their communities by having refugees and immigrants move into their municipalities and help them move their cities forward.
Amelia, in just a very brief answer, I'm just wondering if you could give some sense of the economic impact of refugees here in Vermont.
Very much the same as Lee has mentioned is happening nationally. You know, refugees are homeowners and business owners, landlords. You know, there are restaurants around Burlington and Winooski that we can, you know, enjoy these wonderful foods that otherwise would not be here if it wasn't for refugees. And just, you know, last word, I would like to celebrate the although the number is small, 115 people, it's an opportunity for new life.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Amelia Marjanovic is the director of the Colchester, Vermont office of the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. Amelia, thank you.
Thank you.
And Lee Williams is the senior vice president for the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants based just outside Washington, D.C. Lee, thanks for taking time to be on the program today.
Nina, thanks very much for giving us the opportunity.